UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. Now, today we're going to talk about esophageal cancer from an epidemiological and preventative point of view. We all know that esophageal cancer has very poor prognosis, and even after curative surgical resection, probably just over 30% of our patients survive 10 years. Unfortunately, there are not many things modifiable to improve this. However, if this is caught at an early pre-malignant stage or at a stage of early cancer and treated, survival and quality of life significantly improves for our patients. And personally, in my day-to-day professional life, I really feel fulfilled treating such early stage patients. And such patients are ever so grateful when you avoid a life-changing surgery for them with endoscopic procedures by treating their dysplasia or early cancers. So it does make sense that we focus our attention, resources, and knowledge towards prevention of esophageal cancers. And today's discussion with our guest focuses on this exact aspect of prevention of esophageal cancer. We will mainly focus on adenocarcinomas as a predominant cancer in the West, as the epidemiology would vary compared to the squamous. So I think for purposes of today's discussion, we'll stick to adenocarcinomas. And to talk to us today is our eminent guest, Professor Massimiliano Di Pietro. Massi is a professor of gastroenterology and consultant gastroenterologist at Cambridge University Hospitals in the UK. Massi has dedicated his professional career to research in early esophageal cancers and dysplasias. He's also the lead author for British Society, Barrett's Guidelines, the NICE Guidelines, and is also author of the latest published ESGE Barrett's Management Guidelines. Welcome to the podcast, Massi. Thanks so much for being with us here today.
Thanks, Pradeep, for having me. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you and contribute to this series of UEG podcast.
Massi, let's start with an overview of the problem with esophageal cancer. I mean, the incidence. And can you tell us how has this changed over time with changing rates of obesity and lifestyle changes in the modern world?
Yes, esophageal cancer is not the commonest cancer globally. It's the seventh commonest cancer globally. And it's the sixth leading cause of cancer-related mortality. We will be focusing today mostly on an adenocarcinoma, but it's fair to say that, in fact, squamous cell cancer of the esophagus is the commonest esophageal cancer. And the adenocarcinoma is more common in the West, and is the commoner esophageal malignancy in the 20th most developed countries. In general, esophageal cancer is more prevalent in males compared to females with a ratio of 2-1. And globally, the squamous cell cancer, as I said, is more prevalent with a ratio between squamous cell cancer and adenocarcinoma 6-1. The squamous cell cancer is commoner in the Far East and in the so-called esophageal cancer belt, which spans the South Asia and the East of Africa. But in the part of the world which is closer to the UEG friends, mostly we'll be seeing esophageal adenocarcinoma. Worryingly, it is a cancer which is increasing in its incidence, and latest projections from US show that it's increasing in trend with a slight plateauing more recently. However, the projections for 2040 still consider a 40% increase in the incidence. So this is something that is more prevalent. The incidence is increasing, and it does pose an important medical problem for our practice, especially when we talk about the importance of early detection.
Okay. And maybe we can come to this when you talk about risk factors. I just wondered why that trend is changing. So in my practice, I feel one field where endoscopic therapy has made probably biggest difference in the outcomes of our patients is in treatment of esophageal cancer and dysplasia. And I feel this is an area where there's been a significant shift in management. Of course, in all other areas, there's been a shift in the management. But this has probably changed the lives of our patients the most in terms of their quality of life. So can I pick up your thoughts on how treatment of esophageal cancer is changing with time? And what, as an expert, what do you think how it might change in the future so that we can prepare younger trainees when they choose their career, what specialties they may want to choose?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Pradeep. Certainly in the span of my short career as a gastroenterologist, I have seen a shift in the management options for esophageal cancer. I still remember as a trainee, not a long time ago, that I was seeing quite a few patients for esophageal dilatation having had an esophagectomy for high-grade dysplasia. Well, this will not happen or should not happen anymore these days. I think the endoscopic resection with either EMR or ESD followed by ablation, and there are on different ablation modalities like radiofrequency ablation or cryoablation or argon plasma coagulation, have dramatically changed the treatment pathway for early esophageal cancer. And it is now possible to achieve remission of dysplasia in about 70 to 95% of patients with early disease, according to different studies, and even remission of the premalignant condition Barrett's esophagus in 50 to 90% of cases. So when we talk about early cancer, and if we use the TNM staging, will be what we call T1A adenocarcinoma, and in some respect also for squamous cell carcinoma, the treatment, the gold standard treatment, is endoscopic therapy. As we speak, there is some change occurring also for a slightly more invasive type of early cancer. So it's the cancer invading into the submucosa. Historically, this has been an indication for surgery. And if you look at the guidelines, there is still some, well, most of the guidelines would recommend using surgery for the treatment of early invasive cancer into the submucosa. However, we are now recognizing that the risk of lymph node metastasis in T1B cancer is in fact lower than we previously thought. And I think in the next few years, we'll be seeing also here a paradigm shift. So there's more and more emphasis on endoscopic treatment. And that clearly involves us as a gastroenterologist and also the trainees who will be the future physicians treating this type of cancer. But even in the field of more advanced cancer, which might not necessarily involve us, the majority of us, although in some European countries, gastroenterologists do offer chemotherapy and use chemotherapy as part of their practice, there is a shift. And certainly there are more recent regimens, like, for example, the FLOT chemotherapy regimen or the combination of radiotherapy and chemotherapy, which allow to reach pathological complete response in up to 18% of cases, which is amazing considering that historically only 20% of patients with esophageal cancer would survive in 5 years. So I think there is a lot of research and there is a lot of practice going on, which I truly believe will improve the outcome of patients in the next few years.
So the gist of that, Massey, is that it's well accepted currently that all intramucosal cancers are endoscopically treated. There's a shift towards endoscopic treatment for submucosal invasive cancers. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, absolutely. I think it gets a little bit more complex than that because the endoscopic resection will allow, in cases of early cancer, substaging in the context of submucosal disease and then understand in a more refined way what are the true risks of metastasis and risk stratify the patient. So at the very least, an endoscopic resection is the best staging modality. And then often is a discussion with the patients about benefit and risks of doing more complex treatment or adopt the watch and wait strategy.
So having that knowledge and change in treatment modalities, I think I'm sure most of our listeners will be aware of the risk factors for esophageal adenocarcinoma, but can you recap and outline these and what sort of roughly what is the scale of these in the European population?
Yes, I mean, on a global level, we can certainly say that the general risk factors for esophageal cancer are smoking and alcohol consumption. But this is particularly true for the squamous cell cancer. For adenocarcinoma, it's slightly different, in that smoking is still one of the risk factors. But the most prominent risk factors for esophageal adenocarcinoma are a history of acid reflux and obesity. And that leads to the reason why perhaps the trend of esophageal adenocarcinoma is towards a constant increase, because obesity is a global problem. And the latest projections that it's the global population is getting more obese, and this poses an increased risk for our patients. We should not forget also that even though there aren't any forms of truly hereditary esophageal adenocarcinoma, familial clustering of Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma occurs in about 6% of cases. So you should never forget in the clinic where dealing with these patients, asking questions about family history, because if there is a particular clustering within a family of Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma, that give us some room to offer patients and family members screening. And the basis of this is interesting. So there are some GWAS studies, genome-wide association studies, performed in the past 10 years that show that there are some polymorphisms that are linked to the risk of Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma. In particular, some of them are related to genes involved in muscle differentiation. And there is a theory that that could predispose patients to develop a hiatus hernia and therefore develop acid reflux and in turn Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma. That's a very interesting field where certainly we'll be seeing more data in the next future.
So the way I take that, Massey, with the family history in my clinical practice, based on what you just told me, is that if there's family history of sort of Barrett's related adenocarcinomas, then maybe I will have a low threshold in terms of surveillance, my intervals, or maybe through low threshold in terms of treatment. Is that what your interpretation would be, or in terms of risk stratifying these patients about the risks of future development of cancers?
Yes, absolutely. I think we should be mindful of that. And in fact, some of the guidelines do recommend lowering the threshold for performing an endoscopic examination in people with perhaps some other risk factors, which might be sort of even a milder history of reflux or overweight or obesity, particularly in the context of male sex and white race, which are all the other risk factors related to the two conditions.
Okay. So with that in mind, and I was wondering, what's the potential for prevention of esophageal cancer, maybe in a broader sense? I think it's a bit difficult question to answer, but maybe, I don't know, wonder what your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that we should sort of think about twofold. We should think at the population level and the personal level. I think at the population level, clearly, there is some need for healthcare systems to tackle the increasing problem of obesity. Obesity does not only increase the abdominal pressure and therefore the risk of reflux, but also has an endocrine effect in the body, which is obviously linked not only to Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma, but a lot of other medical problems related to the metabolic syndrome. So I think tackling obesity from a healthcare perspective is what we should be doing, regardless of Barrett's and esophageal adenocarcinoma. Obviously, the main problem is that we cannot just afford a healthcare system to offer an endoscopy to all people over the age of 50 or even to all those that have acid reflux. So I think the other thing that healthcare systems should focus on, and in particular researchers, is to try and develop minimally invasive screening tests to risk stratify patients. And when I say that, it could be ranging from blood tests to volatile compounds in the breath, or minimally invasive cell collection devices that could collect cells from the esophagus with a non-endoscopic approach and then risk stratify. From an individual perspective, I think that awareness is the key. And I think we all see in our practice when seeing patients with reflux symptoms, that often patients consider reflux as part of their normal life. Because they've had reflux for so long, they don't really appreciate that this is a medical symptom. And it, for some of them, for many of them, it's just part of their life. And they are used to take Rennies or other antacids over the counter. I think awareness is important because individuals and people in general should appreciate that acid reflux is not normal and it's risk factors for some other problems. And therefore, it is also clearly important that from a medical point of view, we use sort of interventions to control symptoms and minimize the burden of acid reflux.
So, Massey, I want to talk about Barrett's, the predominant way patients develop adenocarcinomas. Let's go down to the core when patients are first diagnosed. And I feel the one of the most common mistakes in clinical practice is with the diagnosis of Barrett's. We as endoscopists are guilty, I think, of over-diagnosing, probably rather than under-diagnosing mostly. And often hiatus hernia or the term, a lot of my colleagues haven't even heard of the term irregular GOJ. So they're often being diagnosed as Barrett's. And this has huge implications on our patients. You know, you sit with a patient, you subscribe a lifelong PPI and a lifelong surveillance to them. So I think this uses healthcare resources significantly. And I think one of the key is to kind of educate us right at the time of diagnosis. So as per the latest science or latest guidelines, so how would you define Barrett's and how do you differentiate this from the other two I mentioned, you know, hiatus hernia and irregular GOJ, mainly irregular GOJ?
Yeah, so I think it is really essential as endoscopists that we use a systematic approach to the possible diagnosis of Barrett's. As in all the other organs, as in the colon or in the stomach, we have to use a systematic approach, but it's even more true for the diagnosis of Barrett's or when we suspect Barrett's endoscopically. I think if we, on the way down into the esophagus, just after the intubation suspects Barrett's esophagus, we shouldn't spend too much time on the way in because the diagnosis of Barrett's is mostly made and confirmed on the way out. So my personal practice is that I complete my examination. I do a detailed inspection of the stomach to exclude stomach disease. And then on the way back, I approach systematically this diagnosis. So it's really important to understand the endoscopic landmarks of a hiatus hernia and Barrett's esophagus. So the first landmark that we should appreciate on the way back is the so-called diaphragmatic pinch, which is the imprint of the diaphragm on the gastroesophageal lumen. And it appears as a restriction of the lumen just at the level of the upper body. So that's the first landmark that we should take a notice and perhaps record, talking to the nurse, we can record the distance from the incisors. The second landmark that we will appreciate is the gastroesophageal junction. And the best definition of gastroesophageal junction is the top of the gastric folds. Okay, so we should watch carefully the gastric folds. And when the gastric folds stop, that will be our second landmark. Okay. So now the distance between the diaphragmatic pinch and the top of the gastric folds, that is the hiatus hernia. We can discuss what is a significant hiatus hernia, but whatever that value will be, is the size of the hiatus hernia. So if the diaphragmatic pinch, for example, is at 40 centimeters and the top of the gastric fold is at 37 centimeters, this patient will have a 3 centimeter hiatus hernia. After that, we have to look at the extension of the columnar epithelium into the tubular esophagus, which is above the top of the gastric folds. Now, for a diagnosis, for an endoscopic diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus, we need that length to be at least 1 centimeter. We generally use the Prague classification, which is a measure of the circumferential extent as C level, C for Charlie, and maximal extent as a M for Massey level. And we need really at least 1 centimeter of M for an endoscopic diagnosis of Barrett's. And in this case, we would recommend taking biopsies for histological confirmation. Now, historically, in terms of results of the biopsies, there's been some discrepancy among the guidelines in terms of what actually consists in a histological diagnosis of Barrett's. And the crux of the problem is that we really need to have intestinal metaplasia. Even though historically the British Society of Gastroenterology considered the possibility of Barrett's esophagus with gastric metaplasia, this is a moving field, and we really, really think that even in the UK, things will be changing very soon. So we need to focus on intestinal metaplasia because that is the histological hallmark of Barrett's esophagus. Now, if you have an extension which is less than 1 centimeter, then we should really talk about irregular Z-line, which is not an endoscopic diagnosis of Barrett's, and it's a condition which is associated to a negligible risk of cancer.
Now, the core problem lies with this irregular GOJ. So let's say you do an endoscopy and you have a columnar-lined esophagus less than 1 centimeter. Endoscopists, probably purely sort of due to lack of knowledge, they would call it Barrett's, and they take biopsies and there's intestinal metaplasia. So you have a patient with less than 1 centimeter columnar-lined esophagus with biopsy showing intestinal metaplasia. What is your definition of this? What do you call this? And how would you approach this? Would you offer them, what's your definition? What does this patient have?
Yeah, so this patient should not be considered as having Barrett's esophagus. These patients have a condition called intestinal metaplasia at the gastroesophageal junction. Now, I think this is also a moving field. Maybe in the future we'll be saying different things. But at the moment, I think we should stick to what the research data show, because that's what we eventually, as physicians and medical practitioners, we should be focusing on. Okay. So the evidence is that if you have intestinal metaplasia at the level of an irregular Z-line without an endoscopic diagnosis of Barrett's, the risk of cancer is 30-fold lower than that of Barrett's esophagus. And we might be discussing later what the risk is, but actually the risk of cancer in Barrett's esophagus is still very small. So having a risk which is 30-fold lower than a small risk is an incredibly low risk. So I think reassurance for these patients is required. And I think it's also important to draw a parallel with other conditions, for example, the risk of dysplasia in ulcerative colitis. So that risk increases with the extent of the disease. So having a few cells of an intestinal metaplastic phenotype is different from having a greater extent of precancerous field. And in the presence of few cells, which have a clearly abnormal phenotype, but without a field effect in the esophagus, we have to understand that that risk is very, very small. And perhaps the risk of continued monitoring might well overcome the benefit of monitoring a condition which is not at a significant increased risk.
Okay, that's well clarified, Massey. On a practical note, I have a small question, and I'm sure most of our endoscopists will have this question. So the top of the folds that you set to define GOJ, it seems to be a bit of a moving target sometimes, if you're depending on how much you inflate, how much you deflate. Well, in your practice, what do you do?
Well, an endoscopy is a dynamic imaging, okay? So it's not just an image. And it sometimes takes a little bit of time, just a few more seconds, inflating and deflating the organ. Ideally, you should make this judgment not on an overinflated and not on a fully deflated, because in fact, on a fully deflated organ, the folds might actually clearly reach the squamous esophagus. So you have to do a dynamic examination where you think you have to convince yourself about the correct position of the gastric folds. And then often it's helpful to use a open biopsy forceps, which is usually 6-7 millimeter, and use that as a sort of measuring tape, if you like, of the fold, so that to have an idea of what actually is 1 centimeter. If it's longer, the extension of the columnar esophagus, then the open biopsy forceps is probably 1 centimeter in length.
Oh, that's a good practical tip, Massey. Thanks for that. I think for the purpose of time, we have to end this episode here. There's loads more to discuss, and we'll be back next week on March 5th to continue this conversation. Until then, stay tuned and thanks for listening.